Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's November 5th, 1969, and the trial of the Chicago 8 is about to return from recess. The federal courtroom in Chicago is mostly quiet, as both the defense and prosecution sit waiting for the judge to return from chambers. And today, the political activists on trial seem to be on good behavior. But one of the co-defendants, Bobby Seale, isn't planning to keep up the act for much longer. Seale is a leader of the Black Panthers, a political group fighting for racial justice. And he was one of several speakers who came to Chicago last summer, where demonstrators were planning to protest at the Democratic National Convention. Seale wasn't involved in planning the protest. He only agreed at the last minute to come give a few speeches. But now Seale is being charged with conspiracy to incite a riot, charges stemming from clashes that broke out between protesters and the Chicago police. Seale believes the charges are nothing more than a political stunt orchestrated by the administration of President Richard Nixon. And at first, Seale wanted to believe the trial would at least follow basic procedure. But he was quickly proven wrong. Seale's attorney had to miss the trial because of a health issue. So Seale took a risky step and decided to represent himself in court. But Judge Julius Hoffman didn't respond well. The two men got into several heated arguments, and Hoffman took the drastic step of ordering federal marshals to punish Seale for speaking out. A skirmish broke out in court, and a member of law enforcement ended up kicking Seale in the groin. Seale was then carried away to a back room, where he was shackled to a chair. One of the marshals wrapped duct tape around his mouth, leaving him gasping for breath. And once Seale was bound and gagged, he was returned to court, where he sat immobile and silenced. Press images of Seale bound and gagged in the courtroom prompted an immediate public backlash. And after 3 days, Judge Hoffman relented and allowed Seale to return to court without restraints. It was a small concession to Seale's basic constitutional rights. But even though they removed the duct tape from his mouth and the chains from his ankles, Seale knows the judge still wants him to stay quiet. But that's not going to happen. Seale has a legal right to represent himself in court, and he's not going to let the judge scare him into silence. Once court is back in session, Seale rises to address the newest witness, a sheriff from California. But Seale doesn't even get out a single word before Judge Hoffman launches into another heated exchange.
Mr. Seale, I'll have to ask you to sit down, please.
Seale glances at the sheriff, who's sitting in the witness box. He's been planning to question the sheriff about his politics and views on race, points that Seale believes are relevant to the case.
Your Honor, I think I have a right to know if this guy has a problem with the Black Panthers. Now, officer, have you ever killed a Black Panther Party member? Officer, do not answer that. Bailiff, I'd like you to excuse the jury, please.
Your Honor, where are they going? They should hear this.
I would like to note for the record that defendant Bobby Seale has been guilty of disobedient conduct throughout the trial. He has disrupted the orderly administration of justice. And that's a lie. I stood up and spoke on my own behalf. I demonstrated that I wanted to cross-examine a witness.
Why do you insist on making things difficult for me, Mr. Seale?
You're making things pretty difficult for me. I will also note that the record cannot reflect the true intensity and extent of Mr. Seale's ongoing disruptions. Disruptions which in some instances were accompanied by physical violence.
That is another lie. I never attacked anyone, and you know it. I never hit anyone. I was the one who got hit. I was the one who got chained and gagged.
That's enough, Mr. Seale.
No, I'm not done.
Mr. Seale, the court can no longer tolerate your interruptions. It's now clear that further disciplinary measures won't be sufficient.
Seale shoots a look over his shoulders, waiting to see whether the federal marshals are going to return for another brawl. But instead, Judge Hoffman announces he's declaring a mistrial, but only for Bobby Seale, who will no longer be involved in the case. Seale almost begins to celebrate when the judge makes his next announcement. He's sentencing Seale to 4 years in prison for contempt of court. He then orders the marshals to seize and remove Seale. The courtroom breaks out into a frenzy, and Seale looks around, panicked, waiting for someone to intervene. The injustice is staggering. First, Seal was denied his right to represent himself in court, and now he's being sentenced to prison in a unilateral decision by a judge who clearly hates him. Seal begins to protest when a pair of rough hands grip him by the shoulders. A marshal begins leading Seal out of the courtroom, and as he's marched away, Seal takes one last look at his seven former co-defendants, who appear equal parts shocked and hopeless. Seal knows this turn of events does not bode well for the other activists. America's legal system has proven not to be interested in delivering justice. And unless they find some way to fight back against Judge Julius Hoffman, the verdict in this case is nothing but a foregone conclusion. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In August of 1968, thousands of protesters demonstrated at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The goal was to pressure the Democratic Party to end its support for the Vietnam War. But while the demonstrations were initially peaceful, the events soon grew violent as protesters clashed with Chicago police. The following year, eight of the activists involved in the protests were charged with federal crimes, including conspiring to incite a riot. The co-defendants believed the charges were politically motivated and that the Nixon administration was trying to silence critics of the war. And as the group went to trial, they grew increasingly convinced that America's criminal justice system had been rigged in an effort to punish social activists. Judge Julius Hoffman ruled repeatedly in favor of the prosecution, using court procedure to handicap the defense. But the Chicago Seven and their attorneys did not stop fighting. And in the final weeks of the trial, they managed to secure a star witness, one who had the potential to upend the entire case. This is Episode 3, Closing Statement. It's late November 1969, and the mood is somber in a small apartment in Chicago. In the living room, political activist Abby Hoffman is sitting with his head resting between his hands. Beside Hoffman are his six co-defendants, the activists now being called the Chicago Seven, now that Bobby Seale has been severed from the case. Hoffman can see the men are weary and emotionally deflated. Some of them almost look ready to throw in the towel. And Hoffman knows that's exactly what the government has been aiming for. The trial is about to enter its third month, and every step of the way, Hoffman and his co-defendants have faced bullying and potentially illegal maneuvers from America's criminal justice system. The troubles began before the trial even started. Judge Julius Hoffman denied the defendants their choice of legal counsel, refusing to postpone the trial when their lead attorney had to deal with a medical emergency. Since then, the prosecution offered what appeared to be false evidence and managed to remove a member of the jury who could have been sympathetic to the defendants. The defense team has tried to counter these attacks, but they haven't had much success, as Judge Hoffman has openly supported the prosecution at every turn. He sustained nearly all of their objections and blocked the defense from calling key witnesses. The judge even ejected several of the defendant's black supporters from the courtroom spectator section without offering any explanation. It's all begun to add up, and Hoffman knows that he and the other members of the Chicago 7 have reason to be pessimistic, but Hoffman refuses to give in. Today, the group has gathered to review their upcoming strategy for the trial. Some of Hoffman's co-defendants may want to move forward with a more measured approach, aiming to win over one or two of the jurors with a calm, rational argument. But Hoffman believes it's cowardly or even dishonest to take such a safe approach. Hoffman is the co-founder of the Yippies, a radical organization fighting for social change. And if he's learned anything from America's counterculture, it's that being quiet and polite is not how you win the battle. Hoffman is about to begin the conversation, but his fellow activist and co-defendant, Tom Hayden, beats him to it.
All right, guys, it's our turn to call witnesses and start laying out our case. I've got some ideas, and I'm sure you do too, but I thought I'd go first, if you don't mind.
Hoffman shakes his head, grinning. He's not surprised to see Hayden trying to assert his dominance. Hayden is a prominent activist with the New Left, and this isn't the first time he's positioned himself as the group's leader.
Well, Tom, we all know there's not much to figure out. The trial's not being held in a courtroom. It's a big stage, and it's about to be showtime. Abby, come on. We went over this. The trial is not some joke. I'm sorry, are we talking about the same trial? The one where the judge had Bobby Seale wrapped up in duct tape? I'm not saying it's been fair, but we owe it to ourselves to play by the rules unless you want to spend a decade in prison. Playing by the rules? You're not serious. Has the prosecution once, even once, followed the rules governing a fair trial? No. Judge Hoffman sure isn't following the rules. Look, Abby, I'm not denying that they're stacking the odds against us. Well, then if you admit it's not a fair trial, then you can't act like we stand a chance by playing by the rules. Yeah? What's your idea? You want to sing a song? Maybe we should take turns reading a poem by Allen Ginsberg. Well, but hey, you know what? I like that. So why don't we practice? I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical. Look, enough. I make a ridiculous suggestion, and I can't even tell if you're taking it seriously. Abby, when are you going to drop the act and start thinking about actually winning this case?
Hoffman turns from Hayden and strikes a more solemn tone as he addresses the other members of the Chicago 7.
Look, guys, I know Tom here thinks I'm a clown. But sometimes if you want to change people's hearts and their minds, you got to put on a bit of theater. Show them the truth about how things really work. Now, I say if we want to win, we got to disrupt this trial every chance we get. We'll show the country this whole thing isn't fair. It's not justice. It is a joke. It's a joke, a sham version of democracy. And we're the ones who can wake people up to show them that truth. Yeah? Even if showing them the truth means going to prison? Tom, you and I both know history. A lot of important people sacrifice themselves trying to do the right thing. It's our turn.
Hayden shakes his head.
You're implying I'm some kind of coward. I'm not committed to the cause. Now, all I'm saying is the world is watching. Remember that. They've been watching from the beginning. They were watching the streets of Chicago. They're watching the courtroom now. So what do you want them to see?
Hayden spends a moment wrestling with the question before turning back to Hoffman and asking whether he's willing to compromise. They can make some noise, even call out Judge Hoffman directly. But Hayden still wants to present a strong case, one that could earn them a hung jury. There's no reason they can't take a moral stance and make this about something more than just the trial, while also doing everything in their power to remain free men. Hoffman stands and wraps Hayden in a big theatrical hug and says it's a plan. The Chicago 7 are going to make a scene, but along the way, they'll make sure to put up a good fight too and try and stay out of jail. It's early December 1969. In a federal courthouse in Chicago, attorney William Kunstler rises from the defense table and begins making his way over to the jury. Sitting in the jury box are 10 women and 2 men, a group that Kunstler believes is capable of rendering an impartial verdict for the Chicago 7. And while it's been a grueling few months for the defense, Kunstler knows the fight is far from over. In just a few moments, Kunstler is going to begin presenting the defense's case. They've managed to line up over 100 witnesses, and the defense's goal is to show how Chicago city officials and local police were the ones responsible for the violence at the DNC, not the defendants. Kunstler is well aware that his clients want to turn this trial into an act of political theater, and he understands the strategy. They want to call out America's criminal justice system, showing how this trial has been unfair on every meaningful level. And in part, they're hoping the emotional appeal will sway some of the members of the jury. But Kunstler is a skilled lawyer, and for now, he's planning to take a more straightforward approach, methodically building a case with witness testimony and hard evidence. So Kunstler steps to the center of the courtroom and begins presenting his case for the defense. He tells the court he'd like to call his first witness, Dr. Edward James Sparling. Sparling is the president emeritus of Roosevelt University in Chicago. He recently led an independent commission that studied another conflict between Chicago police and activists months before the convention. His group published a report on the incident titled Dissent and Disorder and found that Chicago police had been guilty of using brutal tactics. So Kunstler tells the court that Dr. Sparling can provide key testimony for the defense. His report revealed a pattern of violence in the Chicago PD, and the co-defendants had read that documented history. It is why the defendants decided to come to Chicago, prepared with protective gear, including helmets. Kunstler reminds the court that, of course, the prosecution came to a different conclusion about the helmets. The government believes that by showing up prepared for violence, it's some sort of proof that the activists were preparing to attack the police, that the gear was evidence of an offensive maneuver. But Dr. Sparling can show that the government's interpretation is far from the truth. So Kunstler would like to begin by introducing the report authored by Sparling's commission, looking at the previous clashes in Chicago 4 months before the DNC. Kunstler pauses, waiting for Judge Julius Hoffman to allow this routine admission of evidence, but instead Hoffman shakes his head and denies the request. Kunstler shoots the judge an incredulous look. He says, "Your Honor, we are not going to be permitted to have this witness introduce the report." And Judge Hoffman shakes his head again and says, "That's my ruling," before ordering Kunstler to move on. Kunstler stands frozen in shock. Admitting this kind of evidence is nothing more than a routine matter in a trial. And this specific report offers proof from an independent commission that the Chicago 7 had no intention of inciting violence. Kunstler thought he might finally have a chance to begin building a strong case. But this rejection makes it abundantly clear. Judge Hoffman is still dead set on undermining the defense. And it's not going to get any easier from here. About a week later, William Kunstler takes a seat at the defense table and gets ready for the prosecution to begin a cross-examination. Kunstler just finished questioning one of his witnesses, a woman named Linda Morse, who works as an anti-war activist. Morse did a good job on the stand, recapping some of the weeks leading up to the protests. She explained how she and co-defendant Dave Dellinger tried to get permits and how city officials refused, setting in motion a clash between law enforcement and protesters. Morse also did a good job painting a picture of the outsized response from Chicago police, who turned the protest into a war zone. Overall, Kunstler was very happy with the testimony. He believes Linda Morse offered a compelling argument, showing why Chicago police and city officials ultimately bear the blame for the violence at the DNC. And so as he settles back down at the defense table, Kunstler lets down his guard, feeling satisfied. He just needs to sit and take some notes on the prosecution's cross-examination and push back if there's any unfair line of questioning. Soon enough, federal prosecutor Richard Schultz rises, and from the start, his questions for Linda Morse are designed to make her sound like a violent radical. He gets her to confirm that she practices shooting rifles and that she's trained in karate. Then Schultz pivots and starts asking Morse about her political beliefs. He gets her to admit that she's no longer a pacifist and that she believes the country is ready for a revolution. Schultz then gets to the crux of it, asking, "The only way you can change this country is by a violent revolution. Isn't that your thought?" But Morse responds that people have a right to defend themselves. And when the prosecutor repeats the question, suggesting again that Morse is a violent radical, she says, "No, the way we are going to change the country is by political revolution." Morse then goes on to explain why change is necessary in America, that people from marginalized groups are fighting for their liberty in the face of excessive brutality from police. But in another sudden pivot, the prosecutor asks the court to strike her comments as irrelevant. Kunstler rises from the defense table in immediate protest. The prosecution just led a long and deliberate inquiry into Linda Morse's politics. The questions were designed to paint her as a violent and unhinged political activist and to get the jury to forget her useful testimony for the defense. But Morse clearly performed better than the prosecution expected, She came off as humane and sympathetic. So now the prosecution is trying to get those ideas stricken from the record. Kunstler won't have it. He tells the judge that the prosecution was asking intensely political questions and that Morris was just trying to give a political answer in response. But as always, Judge Hoffman sides with the prosecution. He tells Kunstler that this is not a political case. This is a criminal case. I can't go into politics here in this court. Kunstler and the judge go back and forth a couple more times. But again, Kunstler is overruled, and the judge hands the prosecution another victory. Kunstler slumps back into his chair, feeling demoralized. This may look like an American courtroom, but the ideals of a just and fair trial disappeared from here a long time ago. And Kunstler can't get over the judge's claim that this trial isn't about politics. But as he sits stewing in anger, suddenly Kunstler gets an idea. The truth is, this trial has always been about politics. The charges themselves were a political stunt from the Nixon administration. And maybe that's the answer. If the defense can prove that this case is all about politics and that it's not, as the judge claims, a criminal case, then the defense may be able to get past all the underhanded maneuvers by the judge and prosecution, and they might be able to win over a couple members of the jury and set the Chicago 7 free.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's mid-January 1970, and Tom Hayden is driving a rental car through Northern Virginia, about 20 minutes outside Washington, D.C. Hayden pulls off the highway and heads into a suburban neighborhood full of large houses and tall, barren trees. After driving a few blocks, he parks the car and kills the engine. Hayden steps out and feels the rush of cold air against his skin. As he begins making his way to a three-story house, he exchanges a nervous look with the men who joined him for this trip, his co-defendant John Froines and their defense attorney, Leonard Weinglass. It's been a long day of travel coming all the way from Chicago, and while nothing is certain, Hayden is feeling cautiously optimistic. The three men were finally able to secure a meeting with Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General and a potential star witness for the defense. Clark served under former President Lyndon Johnson, and when he was in office, Clark was asked to examine the clashes at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Ultimately, he chose not to prosecute the leaders of the protest, saying they were not solely to blame for the violence that erupted. But Clark was later overruled. Lyndon Johnson left the White House at the beginning of 1969, and Richard Nixon's attorney general, John Mitchell, came to a different conclusion. Mitchell chose to prosecute Hayden and his fellow activists, a move Hayden has always believed was political. But proving that is difficult and still won't likely be enough to sway a jury. Hayden and his co-defendants need hard evidence. So today, Hayden is going to try to convince the former attorney general to take the stand and explain to the jury why the Chicago 7 should never have been prosecuted in the first place. Hayden, Froines, and Weinglass cross the yard and reach the front door of Clark's house. Hayden knocks, and when the door swings open, he finds Ramsey Clark welcoming them with a friendly smile.
Guys, come on in. It's freezing out there.
Hayden and the two other men step inside and follow Clark into a study with wood-paneled walls and a large bookcase. But as Hayden glances across the room, he notices two men in suits standing by the fireplace. Hayden turns back to Clark.
I'm sorry, sir. Who are these two? Well, Tom, I appreciate you coming all the way from Chicago, but we couldn't do this meeting just the four of us. These two gentlemen are with the Department of Justice. I felt it was only proper to inform them that you were coming here. So they were sent to observe and take notes. I hope you don't mind.
Hayden tries not to lose his cool. These men are likely to report straight back to their boss, John Mitchell, and probably help the prosecution in Chicago. But Hayden knows he doesn't have much of a choice. If this is what Clark wants, he'll just have to go along with it.
Okay, Mr. Clark, that's fine. We do appreciate your taking the time to meet with us, and I know you don't have all day, so I'll try to make this brief. We're aware that you declined to indict us back when you were the sitting attorney general. So, to start with, could you explain why you made that decision?
Well, the why of it is pretty simple. My staff in Chicago told me that they spoke with your co-defendant, Rennie Davis. They said that he was trying to get permits in the lead-up to the convention. They also said that while Davis was pretty flexible, pretty reasonable, that wasn't the case for the officials in Chicago.
So it's your understanding that the city officials were at least partly to blame for what happened?
I think so, yeah, that's right.
And I learned it wasn't just an issue with the permits. I got first-hand accounts of what sounded like some, well, pretty upsetting police brutality.
Well, that's no lie. I can give you my own first-hand account. But it's one thing to hear that stuff from me or some other activist. It's almost like we're expected to accuse the police of something. It would be something else entirely if we could get the testimony of a former attorney general of the United States.
Yeah, Tom, well, I've got to admit, I've been thinking about this a lot. And I don't know if it's my place to get involved. This is a highly visible trial. You've been making national headlines for months.
Yeah, we have.
And you, sir, could be the difference between me and six other men going to prison just because the president doesn't like our politics.
You may be right.
If that's the case, please come to Chicago. Give your testimony. You don't have to pick sides or get involved in the fight. Just state the facts, and then you can come home to Virginia.
For a moment, Clark stares at the ground, looking troubled. Hayden knows this is a major decision for the former attorney general. He's no longer in power, but testifying in the Chicago trial would invariably thrust him back into the spotlight and subject him to withering public scrutiny. But when Clark looks back up, he gives the men a nod and says he's willing to testify, believing it's the right thing to do. But just as quickly, Clark receives pushback from one of the men from the Department of Justice standing over by the fireplace. The official steps forward and says that if Clark testifies in Chicago, he could damage his reputation. It'll seem like he's injecting politics into a federal trial, a process that isn't supposed to be about Democrats or Republicans. But Clark says this isn't about politics. And it doesn't matter that he served under a Democratic president or that the current administration is run by a Republican. All that matters is the truth, making sure the jury is equipped with the facts. Clark's decision is final. He'll be there in Chicago, prepared to take the stand. It's January 28, 1970, and federal prosecutor Richard Schultz is preparing to navigate one of the most crucial moments in the trial of the Chicago Seven. Somehow, the defense got former Attorney General Ramsey Clark to testify. When Clark was in office, he chose not to prosecute the activists. And by getting Clark to come take the stand, Schultz knows the defense may now have a silver bullet, a strong argument that the case is politically motivated and that President Nixon's administration is just trying to silence his critics. Schultz believes that line of argument is specious at best. He was in Chicago during the protests. He saw activists taunting the police and inviting trouble. He doesn't believe for a second that they wanted a peaceful protest. And at the same time, the defendants have made a mockery of the courtroom. They've blown kisses at the jury, performed handstands in court. They even draped the defense table with the flag of the Viet Cong. The enemy, American troops, are fighting right now in South Vietnam. Schultz has no sympathy for these political radicals, and he believes it's the job of the federal government to hold them accountable, making sure they don't do any more damage to America's democracy in the courtroom or in the streets. So Schultz is going to do everything in his power to block the former attorney general's testimony and avoid giving the defense an easy way out. The court is about to resume session when Schultz stands and tells Judge Julius Hoffman that he'd like to make a request. He's aware Ramsey Clark has been subpoenaed to testify, but if the former attorney general is going to take the stand, the jury should not be present for his testimony.
Across the aisle, lead defense attorney William Kunstler jumps up from his seat and calls the request unacceptable, saying it's a violation of the defendant's rights. The former attorney general of the United States is willing to testify before a jury. What he has to say is highly relevant to the case and should not be turned into a private conversation. Judge Julius Hoffman looks at the two attorneys, then rules that Clark can be brought to the stand for some preliminary questioning without the jury. If the judge deems the defense's questions to be relevant, he'll allow the jury to hear the testimony later. Schultz represses a smile. This wasn't exactly the ruling he was after, but it's good enough. A minute later, Ramsey Clark steps into the courtroom, looking dapper in a dark gray suit. He takes a seat in the witness stand, and then the defense begins its preliminary questioning without the jury. William Kunstler asks Clark about his conversations with former President Lyndon Johnson. He wants to know what the two men discussed around the time of the 1968 Democratic National Convention. But as soon as the question is asked, Prosecutor Schultz embarks into his next plan of attack. He objects to the question, saying that these discussions involve national security and should not be made public. Judge Hoffman nods and sustains, striking down the defense's question. Kunstler looks baffled, and he makes a vain attempt to change the judge's mind, but the argument goes nowhere. And over the next hour, Schultz continues with the same line of attack, objecting to the defense's questions at every opportunity. Judge Hoffman continually sides with the prosecution. And in the end, the former attorney general is only able to provide snippets of information, nothing that could help the defense. So when Kunstler finishes his preliminary questions, Schultz decides it's time to go for the jugular. He tells the judge that he doesn't think Clark can provide any relevant or material evidence to the case. Therefore, Schultz does not believe Clark should be allowed to give public testimony in front of a jury. Again, Judge Hoffman nods, agreeing with the argument. And with that, he makes a final decision, saying the former U.S. Attorney General is barred from testifying. Neither of the legal teams can even mention to the jury that Clark was here in court. Schultz glances over at the defendants and their attorneys and can see that they look crestfallen. And while Schultz certainly doesn't enjoy such a lopsided victory, he's still pleased. The defense is now without their star witness. They've got nothing. And so it's only a matter of time before this trial wraps up and the jury comes back with a guilty verdict. 2 weeks later, attorney William Kunstler sits down at the defense table and begins paging through a yellow legal pad full of handwritten notes. Kunstler has written down a lot of big, heady ideas, lots of impassioned arguments and high-minded thoughts about justice. But in the end, the speech only comes down to a single demand. The jury should find the defendants not guilty. Kunstler puts down the legal pad and sits back in his chair, trying to calm himself. In a few minutes, he's going to give closing arguments in the trial of the Chicago 7. It's been a long journey. And while at times it's been harrowing, there have been some highlights. The defense ended up calling 104 witnesses, including poet Allen Ginsberg, folk singer Judy Collins, and comedian Dick Gregory. The defense wanted to convey the idea that this trial is not just about a set of limited criminal charges. It's about civil rights and the peace movement. Kunstler believes he's done a decent job, even though Judge Julius Hoffman has stacked the odds in the prosecution's favor. And of course, things have gotten a bit out of hand from time to time. Just last week, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman came to court dressed as judges themselves, wearing long black robes. Judge Hoffman ordered them to remove the garments. The co-defendants said okay. They tossed their robes to the floor and began stomping on them. It was another one of their theatrical performances. But Kunstler believes all the acting out has been worthwhile. The jury needs an emotional reminder that this trial has been deeply unfair. So although getting dressed up in costumes is unorthodox, Kunstler believes it's had an effect. But now, all that's left is to make a strong closing statement and wait for the verdict. Soon, Kunstler arises and approaches the jury box. He begins his speech with some history, a way to appeal to the sense of the moment. Kunstler reminds the jury that the prosecution has derided the Chicago 7 as outside agitators. But Kunstler points out that agitators and renegades have been responsible for some of the greatest reforms in world history. Susan B. Anthony, Martin Luther King Jr., Harriet Tubman, Gandhi, even Jesus. Every one of these men and women were also what the prosecution would call outside agitators. And Kunstler tells the jury that these are the public figures who give us our biggest and greatest ideas. It's not the police or prosecuting attorneys, not even judges.
The greatest change comes from the despised, the outcasts, the people who dare to be rebels, people like the defendants. Kunstler paces the courtroom, working himself into a fever pitch of emotion. He tells the jury that the world is facing some enormous problems: racism, poverty, war. But these existential issues won't go away by silencing political activists. And in the end, that's the main question the jury is about to deliberate: whether Americans should have the freedom to speak boldly and without fear. That is what's at stake. That's the reason the jury should acquit the defendants of all charges. A moment later, Kunstler retakes his seat at the defense table. He's proud of what he had to say, and it seems like he got through to at least a couple members of the jury. Could have sworn he saw a few people on the verge of tears. But now all he and his clients can do is wait for the jury to render a verdict and pray that the judge and prosecutors don't have any more dirty tricks.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop. Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
It's February 14th, 1970. In the federal courtroom in Chicago, activist Dave Dellinger shuffles forward, flanked by a pair of armed federal marshals. As he makes his way to the defense table, Dellinger gazes out at the large crowd gathered in the courtroom. It includes journalists and members of the public, a motley crew of strangers who've gathered to watch one of the most spectacular trials of the decade. But also sitting in the gallery are two very familiar faces, Dellinger's two daughters. The eldest is 22 and looks calm and poised, but his younger daughter is only a teenager and appears to be on the verge of tears. Dellinger knows this whole ordeal has been a lot to handle for his family, so he locks eyes with his teenage girl and gives her a big smile, then points his jaw and pushes it upward, motioning for her to keep her chin up. They'll get through this. When Dellinger reaches the defense table, he nods at his six co-defendants, trying to appear stoic and unbothered. But he can tell the other men are just as upset as his two girls. Dellinger is 54 and by far the oldest of the group. But for the last 10 days, he's been treated like a violent criminal. The problem began when Dellinger called out one of the prosecution's witnesses, accusing them of lying under oath about Dellinger's actions in Chicago. But instead of just banging his gavel and calling the court to order, Judge Julius Hoffman revoked Dellinger's bail and ordered him to spend the remainder of the trial behind bars. Dellinger has been a lifelong pacifist. He demonstrates for issues like world peace and racial equality, and normally he avoids conflict. But he knows that might have to change. The injustices in this trial have been overwhelming, and today Dellinger is guessing he's about to face another round of vindictiveness and misconduct from the judge. In a few minutes, Judge Hoffman is going to sentence the defendants for their counts of contempt of court, offenses they've racked up throughout the trial while defying the judge's orders. The timing is especially galling. The jury has been sent away to deliberate the main criminal charges of the case, but Judge Hoffman didn't have any patience. He was ready to dole out punishment to the Chicago Seven. And Dellinger is not sure what's going to happen when Judge Hoffman calls court back into session. But Dellinger is trying to prepare for the worst, including more violence. Judge Hoffman takes his seat at the bench.
All right, we're going to begin with the sentences for contempt, beginning with David Dellinger. Mr. Dellinger, please rise.
Dellinger stands and stares at the judge.
Mr. Dellinger, you are hereby sentenced to 29 months and 16 days on 32 counts of contempt. Do you have anything to say in regards to this punishment?
Yes, I do. The government wanted us to be like good Germans, supporting the evils of our decade. But we refused and came to Chicago and demonstrated.
Marshals, please have Mr. Dellinger sit back down.
You want us to stay in our place like black people who are supposed to stay in their place. Like poor people who are supposed to stay in their place. Like women were supposed to stay in their place. Like people without formal education are supposed to stay in their place.
Marshals, take him out of my court.
Dellinger glances over his shoulder and sees a group of federal marshals rushing through the courtroom.
But do you see? The people no longer will be quiet. People are going to speak up.
Dellinger begins bracing for impact. It's probably only a matter of seconds before the marshals grab him and haul him back to a dark cell. But then Dellinger hears a cry from the gallery. His teenage daughter had been cheering for him, but now several marshals are grasping at her, trying to pin her down.
Hey, get your hands off her! Get off her!
I said take him out of my court!
Dellinger sees one of the marshals now has his daughter by the throat.
Leave her alone!
Dellinger lunges forward, trying to protect his daughter. But federal marshals hold him back and begin dragging him through the aisle. Dellinger struggles against their grip, gasping in exertion. He has to get to his daughter. But then Dellinger decides to go limp. The marshals are only restraining his daughter by her arms. And Dellinger lets out a sigh of relief, deciding that from here on out, he needs to stop resisting, stop giving law enforcement pretext for violence. He allows himself to be dragged out of the courtroom, and as he passes by his daughter, he reaches out and briefly touches her hands, just as his co-defendant, Rennie Davis, shouts out above the noise, telling Judge Hoffman, "You have just jailed one of the most beautiful, courageous men in the United States." But Hoffman only sneers back at Davis, and with a menacing tone tells him, "Okay, now we'll take care of you." On February 18, 1970, the jury returned with a verdict. All the members of the Chicago Seven were acquitted on charges of criminal conspiracy, but five of the defendants were found guilty of crossing state lines to incite a riot. Only John Froines and Lee Weiner were acquitted on all charges. Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, Tom Hayden, Abby Hoffman, and Jerry Rubin were each sentenced to 5 years in prison, but their convictions prompted an immediate public outcry, and nearly 500,000 Americans took to the streets in protest. 2 years later, a U.S. Court of Appeals revisited the case and found that Judge Julius Hoffman had demonstrated systemic bias against the defense. The appellate court went on to overturn all the criminal convictions, and the federal government declined to try the defendants a second time. But the appeals court did rule the defendants should have a new trial, addressing their charges of contempt of court, charges issued by Judge Hoffman. That second trial was held in 1973, and out of the defendants' 159 charges of contempt, only 13 were ruled to be valid. The judge declined to impose jail sentences for any of them. In 1971, Abby Hoffman published a best-selling book titled Steal This Book. It was viewed by many as the definitive guide to the radical lifestyle of the 1960s. But 2 years later, he had another brush with America's criminal justice system and was arrested for dealing cocaine. Hoffman went into hiding, but reemerged 7 years later. Tom Hayden went on to write multiple books and was elected to California's state legislature. During his 18-year career in politics, Hayden was described by the Sacramento Bee as the conscience of the Senate. Black Panther leader Bobby Seale was ordered to stand trial in New Haven, Connecticut, in connection with a murder. But the charges were eventually dropped, and Seale returned to California, where he continued a career as an activist and author. Dave Dellinger remained a full-time social activist, but his co-defendants Jerry Rubin and Rennie Davis transitioned into new careers as businessmen. Judge Julius Hoffman remained on the bench until his death in 1983. He defended his conduct during the Chicago trial, saying, "I did nothing in that trial I'm not proud of. I presided with dignity." It's been over 50 years since the trial of the Chicago Seven, but many of the issues raised in that courtroom are still relevant today as Americans continue grappling with the issues of free speech, social activism, and police brutality. And although many Americans have grown cynical and distrustful of the government, defendant Abby Hoffman came away from the trial with a message of hope. Hoffman said, I grew up with the idea that democracy is not something you believe in or a place you hang your hat, but it's something you do. You participate. If you stop doing it, democracy crumbles and falls apart. Young people, don't give up hope. If you participate, the future is yours. From Wondery, this is episode 3 of the Chicago 7 for American Scandal. In our next episode, I talk with historian and author Michael Kazin about the legacy of the 1960s, an era that transformed the country and which set in motion the culture wars still dividing Americans today. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about the Chicago 7, we recommend the books The Autobiography of Abby Hoffman, Reunion by Tom Hayden, From Yale to Jail by David Dellinger, Seize the Time by Bobby Seale, My Life as a Radical Lawyer by William Kunstler with Sheila Eisenberg, and Conspiracy in the Streets, edited by John Wiener. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details, and while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz, edited by Christina Malzberg. Our senior producer is Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louis for Wondery.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, 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 where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.